Together. It's a passage that appears with slight variations in the Midrash, in Eicha Rabba, and in the Yerushalmi. Just to begin on a personal note, although I don't usually insert this kind of personal observation, I feel I should share with you context in which I gave this year almost exactly 2 years ago. On Shabbat Chazon in Neveh Kalim Kushkutim. The reason that it's relevant, I think, will emerge as we consider what this passage is coming to tell us. For starters, let's read it. I'd like to read it together with you. And once we have a sense of the forest at large, to return to all of the individual motifs of this passage and consider just what it's telling us. Uda hava bechad barnash dehava karade. This is the story of a man who was plowing. Gat chadatote. One of his oxen lowed. Avari rabei chad arabi. An Arab passed by him. Amare said to him, Ma, what are you? Amare Yehudai ana. He said, I am a Jew. Amare, the Arab said, Shari Torah, the Shari Padna. Untie your ox and untie your plow. Amarle Rama. The Jew said, why? Amarle, the Arab said, the Beit Makdashundi Udai Chariv. Because the temple of the Jews was destroyed. Amarle, Menayah. The Jew said, when did you know? Amarle Hidait Min Gayata de Torah. The Arab said, I knew from the low of your ox. Well, while all this is going on, the passage continues, Ad dahava afik imei ga'at zina achriti. While he was busy with him, the axe lowed another time. Amaro, the Arab said to him, Asar tonach, asar tonach. Bind your axe, bind your plow. The idilid tarik hung the Yudai. For the Redeemer of the Jews was born. Well, at this point he doesn't ask how you know. I guess it's obvious. Amaro, what he does ask, is, Jew said to him, Umashmei. And what is his name? You can extract an awful lot of information from the way an ox lows. Amarlo Menachem Shmei. The Arab said to him, Menachem is his name. Ve'ori Mashmei. And his father, what is his name? Amarle Chizkia. The Arab said to him, Chizkia. Amarle Vechan Sharyan. The Jew said, and where do they dwell? Amarle Bevihat Arava. Beit Lechem Yehuda. The Arab said in the capital of Arabia, in Beit Lechem of Yehuda. Apparently, they're not aware that Beit Lechem was ever a capital in Arabia, or that it was even considered a significant city for Arabs until our generation. So that's a side point. In any case, he doesn't ask him any further identifiers from the low of the ox. That evidently suffices. What happens next is, Zavinau Gavra Tavoy. Zavin Padmei, that man sold his oxen, sold his plow, and he became a seller of felt swaddling clothes for babies. What we would undoubtedly describe as a traveling diaper salesman. Ala lakalka, v'nafak lakalka, ala limedina, v'nafak limedina. He went from town to town, from country to country, literally would enter the towns and leave them, and the countries and leave them, ad dimnat al-tanan, until he came there, Wherefore, at this point, the identity of there is self-evident. Having come there, all the townsfolk came to buy from him, which evidently was his agenda, except and that woman, the mother of that baby, who it clearly emerges here, was the focal point of all of his efforts all along, did not buy for him. Now there are two versions of the continuation of the dialogue. In the Midrash, Amala Lama Late Anat Zvant Levitin Leokin, he said to her, why are you not buying swaddling clothes for babies? Amrale de Khashiet Kashi Leyuki. She said to him, because hard fates are in store for my baby. Amarla Lama said to her, why? Amrale, she said to him, the Aligloi Kharab Bit Makdisha. Because attendant to his birth, the temple was destroyed. There's a somewhat more grating version of the exchange that appears in the Yerushalmi, in which at least initially, he isn't even directly aware of who she is. Rather, Shemat Kalan de Shaya Amrin, Ine Ibn Nachem, Aiti Zuchin Nivrach. He heard the voice of the women saying, Nachem's mother, take purchases for your son. Amra, listen to this. She said, Bai Ana Mechnekuni, son of Hundi Yisrael. She said, I want to strangle him, that enemy of Israel. This is a mother talking about her own baby. For on the day upon which he was born, the temple was destroyed. In either version, the continuation is an assurance. Amarla, he said to her, we trust in the master of the universe, that attendant to him, the temple was destroyed, and attendant to him, it will be rebuilt. In the Yerushalmi, there's an additional level to the dialogue, that is, Amralei lately pleading. She said to him, doesn't make a difference, I don't have any money. And of course, again, we realize that she has been the sole focal point of all of his efforts, going from town to town and country to country all along. So, he's desperate. Amara, the whole nice partner! He said to her, why does it matter to me? It's literally him. I think Zvuzne Lay, take purchases for your son. In late Kumach Yomadain, Bakar Yomin Ana Ati Unsiv. If you have nothing to pay today after a time, I shall come and take the money. In any case, the continuation, Amala, he said to her, Atavena Siva Lich Min Ilain Levitin the Anukich, you take these swaddling clothes for your baby. O Bakar Yomin Ana Ati Levitach Unsiv Parayich. And after a time, I shall come to your home to take payment. So, Nasa, Azza, she took and went. Levatar Yomin, Amar HaGavra, after time, that man said, Izil ve'ich mehavu yanuka, my Gavi, I shall go and see that baby, what are you doing? Atta l'gava, he went to Menachem's mother, Amar la, hu yanuka, my Gavi, he said to her, baby, what are you doing? Amralei, she said to him, Lo amarit lach, bechashye kashye, did I say to you that hard fates were in store for him? I feel all that glay in Chashim. His omen was even attended to him from birth. Demin ha'ishata, atyan ruchim ve'il ulim, te'onune ve'azlim. For from that time when you left me, winds and storms came and carried him away. So mother describing with equanimity how winds had snatched her baby out of her hands and she no longer knows where he is. That's not the end of the story. There's still one additional line in the dialogue. Amara said to her, V'lokach amarit lach te'al migloi charav v'al migloi mipnei. Did I not say to you that attended to him, it was destroyed, and attended to him, it will be rebuilt? There's a kind of postscript to the story, and that is, Amara b'yavon, said Rabbi Yavon, why should I need to learn the result of the temple's destruction with the name of birth from Arabs? And not an explicit scriptural verse. For it is written, and Lebanon in all of Talmudic and Midrashic literature alludes to the temple, as in the beginning of this week, etc. Ha'ar Hakov Hazeh de HaLevanon, which the Midrash also understands as an allusion to the temple. So the verse is, and Levanon shall fall by a mighty one, again alluding to the temple. Uchtib Batrei, and it is written afterward, immediately afterwards, V'yatzachot el-migizah Yishai, v'nitzah v'sharashar Yitzvet, and there shall come forth the shoots from the stock of Yishai, and a branch shall grow out of its roots, of course, alluding to Mashiach, alluding to the Redeemer. That's the story. And now, of course, manifestly, having gotten some sense of the forest and the manifold cryptic motifs that I think we can all discern readily in the story, we need to go back and try to figure out what it is. So, taking two, but this time with feeling. Before we actually begin on the content of the story, there is a crucial insight that I need to share with you, and it appears at the top of the second page from Maharal. And that is that none of this actually happened. At least, that none of it happened as a physical, palpably discernible event. Said Maharal, the Haleida, Zot eina mamash gashmit. Kmo shehaya inyan kol leida. This is not a tangible, physical birth. I should stress that from Maharal's perspective, that manifestly doesn't mean it's not true. It's true, but on a conceptual level. It's true, but abstracted from physicality. Likewise, he says, all of the narrative regarding him becoming a diaper salesman, the Al Medina, the Nachak Al Medina, going from town to town, country to country, kol hadvarim ha'elohem sichliim. All of these are to be understood on an intellectual plane, not on a material plane. Shekach mitchayev mitzad ha'sechel ha'moshah. That all this derives from abstracted intellect. So again, with that as a premise, that is, we aren't speaking of some historical narrative. If anything, of course, that only exacerbates our problem and magnifies our responsibility to place this narrative in some kind of intellectual, conceptual framework. This is the story of a man who was plowing. What's the significance of plowing? Well, what associations do we have with plowing? A very obvious halakhic one. It's on the list of, exactly, one of the lamed etymologies. One of the 39 archetypal forms of melacha, creative labor, that are forbidden on Shabbat. All of those forms of labor, after all, signify doing a creative act that provides us with the wherewithal to exert our dominion over the world, and by doing so, to advance the world to some threshold of completeness. So, plowing the world is a form of being metaken the world. This man who is plowing is doing what, on some level, each and every one of us is summoned to do. We should know, additionally, Midrash, when Noach is born, this one will console us from our actions, deeds, and the sorrow of our hands, says the Midrash, Noach created plowshares. That is, again, the wherewithal to grapple with an otherwise recalcitrant world and to somehow get it to submit to human endeavor. To take what would have otherwise been a rock-strewn patch and make it into an arable field. Again, to engage essentially in that endeavor that we articulate at least three times daily, L'taken olam b'malchut Shaddai. To perfect the world under the reign of the Almighty. That's what he's doing. Again, like all of us should be doing. Until the ox slows. And of course, again, the Arab passes by and essentially tells him, there's no point. The temple is destroyed. Now, you know, with respect to the news about the temple having been destroyed, that if we cast this as a dramatic scene, there are, of course, three characters on stage, right? Three characters. The Jew, the Arab, and the ox. How many are aware of the temple having been destroyed? Well, there's a progression. First, the ox. Second, the Arab. The only one who's clueless on the subject is the one to whom, if anything, the destruction of the temple should be most relevant. How could it be that an ox would discern something that a human being could not? Again, of course, we're speaking on an abstracted plane, but nonetheless, obviously is the message here. Human beings are endowed with an intellect. Human beings have consciousness. Human beings have the wherewithal to understand. Human beings can be proactive in grappling with the world. What can an ox do? As Maharal expresses it, all of those advantages that human beings have are provisional advantages, and here they all serve as a liability. There's at some level, to the extent that you are endowed with an intellect and have the wherewithal to take an active role, you're less sensitive to the inputs from the world. The ox, which by contrast is simple and quiescent, absorbs the vibes, as it were. This is the next passage in Maharal, where he speaks of Ba'alei ha-chayim she'inam medabrim mekablim hergesh milamala yoter min ha'adam. The dumb animal in this vein has an advantage over man. And so again, it is the ox that discerns the change that has taken place in the very fabric of existence to a degree that a human observer does not. But if anything, the human observer who gleans this information from the ox is not the Jew, but rather the Arab. Yes?
Does Maharal say anything similar about Bilam? When we have
Certainly, definitely. That's the solid and understanding. Obviously, the narrative of the donkey discerning the malach to an extent that a human being cannot. But that, in a sense, Chazal already said. That is, Chazal speak of the animal discerning the mazel, even though it doesn't have the wherewithal to commune with any kind of higher level of existence. Obviously, this issue with respect to Bilam, I won't get into because it would necessarily take us into a machokas rishonim. That is, predictably, Rambam understands the whole narrative in a very different fashion. But the idea certainly would connect those passages.
Just clarify what you tell.
Sure.
The notion that the human didn't understand when the ox could, is that part of the design plan, or is that a flaw of the human?
No, it's an inevitable consequence of the very fact that we have an active intellect. Again, in Maharal's presentation, the very fact that the animal is simple and quiescent endows the animal with a receptivity to the vibes of reality to an extent that the human being lacks.
And it's quantitative? The more perceptive you are, the less perceptive you are?
Hey, don't you see that in life?
If we're not talking Washington, D.C., not always.
I think it extends beyond Washington.
There's always that interplay. The more we talk, the less we understand. Consider... I'll give you another parallel example from a totally different domain, just to cogitate on. Consider the Gemara in Masechet Menachot Daf Kaf Tet Amud Bet that describes Moshe Rabbeinu and his interaction with Rabbi Akiva. And after having ascended on high to receive the Torah and asked to see the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva, and he doesn't understand what's going on there, he comes back to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and says, you have someone like this and you're giving the Torah to me? And what's God's answer? This would be a really great place to learn pedagogical procedure from. What does God say? Stop! Of course, he didn't necessarily yell, but being silent, thus has the thought arisen before me. That's exactly the same response that appears two lines later in the Gemara, after he sees the fate of Rabbi Akiva, that they're weighing out his flesh in the meat market. And he says, Zot Torah Zoschara, and again the divine response is, Stok Kachal Machzel Zamai. Where the implication undoubtedly again is, this is something that relates to the Kivyachol Machsher Hashem, the divine thought that predates creation. This is something that you will never truly be able to understand, but bear in mind, the more you express yourself, the less you will understand. That is, the more you affirm yourself, the more you engage in being proactive, the less you'll have the wherewithal to be able to absorb something from beyond you.
Am I correct in concluding that Rambam would violate the scriptures?
That's an interesting question, and I'm not so sure that would necessarily be the case. That is, it is certainly true that the focus on activating one's intellect is one that is preeminent in Rambam, but I should note that that's also the case in Maharal. That is, in this vein, Maharal is a strident Maimonidean. I think it's more a matter of recognizing that by expressing oneself, by being proactive, one allows less of an opportunity for the Seichel to indeed function. Granted, again, there's definitely an element here in which Rambam would stridently demur. And that's the dumb animal. Again, but so far as a human being, with respect to Moshe Rabbeinu, being silent in order to be able to understand, I don't think anyone would necessarily agree with that.
It's Rambam's notion of the palace and the smarter you are, the closer you get.
You're necessarily become smarter by speaking more. As again, we're talking about the aspect of being active here. I gotta reiterate, with respect to the animal dimension, that's certainly one with which Rambam would differ. But with respect to shtok, in order to understand, I think it's something that we could all relate to. In any case, to return to our story, yes?
Could it be parallel to the idea that Yuria brings up the other story?
Well, I don't know if you have to get that deep with respect to... I don't know if you have to get that deep with respect to the analogy that the Navi presents there. Because after all, they're speaking merely about the basic natural orientation of having a debt of gratitude to the hand that feeds you. In that vein, if anything, I would say the more salient observation is, as expressed in the Baraita in Avot Rabbi Natan, Perek Tet Zayin, animals don't have a yitzhara. That is, animals function in a purely natural context as opposed to man that can thwart the most elementary dictates of nature. I'm noting the Baraita of other Rehantan, despite the fact that the Gemara in Masechet Brachot of Samachala seems to indicate otherwise, because the Gemara has to be understood in a different fashion. But I won't get into that right now, because I'm certainly taking it far afield. In any case, to return to our discussion here, apart from the ox, we have the Arab. The Arab, again, has an insight that the Jew does not. And that necessarily impels us to consider what the relationship is between the Arab, archetypal member of the nations of the world, and the temple. On the second pasuk of Eicha, Bako Tivke Balayla, there are a number of drashot that appear in the Midrash. The one that's germane for our purposes, which is the bold-faced last two lines of the next source from Eicha Rabbah, commenting on the double language of Bachot Tivke, says, Bachot Bocha Umivaka Shiv'im Umotima. The double crying is not just that we are weeping, but also the nations of the world are weeping. Amar B'Tinchas Otam Shiv'im Parim Shayu Yisrael Makivim Bachag Keneged Shiv'im Umotem Kidei Shlo Yitzeh HaOlam Mehem. But the 70 bulls are brought on Sukkot, correspond to the nations of the world in order to save them from the fate of desolation. So the nations of the world have some connection with the temple as well. Moreover, with respect to the precedence of the Arab's awareness to that of the Jew, I have to share with you a note, an observation that I heard from someone a number of years ago. This is, I guess I could best describe it as a Dvar Torah from one of the Makoya. Familiar with the Makoya, the Japanese group that are exceedingly devoted to Israel, Havei Israel. So this person asked his Makoya friend, how is it that you guys seem to have so much keener sense of the role and mission of the nation of Israel in the world than an awful lot of Jews? Whereupon his Makoya friend responded, why are you so surprised? It's a Mefarash Pasuk. And we say it in the Shiur HaOlah before benching. That is, first, as the nations of the world have the appreciation that God has dealt prodigiously with them, referring to us. Only subsequently, only afterwards does that awareness dawn upon us. So again, in the progression here, it's first the Arab, then the Arab, then the Jew. And the message, again, we reiterate, is, you were engaged in plowing the world, you were engaged in fixing up the world and perfecting the world, forget it. The temple is destroyed. The mission is over. There's nothing left to do. This sentiment is one we find articulated by the Gemara. That is, the bottom source on page 2, Gemara in Bar Basra, when the second temple was destroyed, there was proliferation of ascetics in Israel who refrained from eating meat and drinking wine. whereupon Rabbi Yehoshua insinuates himself into their company. Amalahem, asked them, why are you desisting from eating meat and drinking wine? And they exclaim by way of response, we're going to eat meat that used to be brought upon the altar and now is no more. We're going to drink wine, which was brought as libations upon the altar and now is no more. So Rabbi Yehoshua says, okay, if so, lechem lamachal, we also should eat bread. After all, there are no meal offerings being brought. So they respond, oh, good idea, we'll stop eating bread. We can make do on fruit. Not so fast, says Rabbi Yehoshua. Even fruits were brought upon in the temple as first fruits, bikurim, and that is also no more. Good idea. We won't eat those fruits. But as Shabbos Yelot Achirim, after all, as much as the Bikurim were only brought from the seven species that the Torah specifies as those with which Eretz Yisrael is praised, so you can bring other fruits for consumption, alternatives to them that aren't brought into the temple as part of the Bikurim. Yeah, but Rabbi Yehoshua hasn't finished with them. There's also a water libation in Sukkot, so we shouldn't drink water. Ah, for that, you got them. They didn't have any answer to that. Shabbos. Whereupon Rabbi Yehoshua attempts to explain to them, Banai, Bovo, Malachem, my children, let me tell you something. Shaloni Davil Kolikali, Shashikon, Zerakid, I do not mourn at all. It's impossible because the decree was already decreed. But, simultaneously, Davil Yetemi by Yeshar, Shein Gozin, Zerah, Tibu, Elaim Kid, Rab Tibu, Yechoim, Lamodla. To mourn excessively is impossible because one can't decree upon the community something that most of the community would not be able to endure. And as a result, the Gemara prescribes a compromise in which when you have a lavish feast, something is left missing. When you plaster your home, you leave a square cubit unfinished, because as long as God's house is incomplete, your house is incomplete. The bridegroom goes to chuppah with ashes, place where he is tefillin. The woman, bride, doesn't bedeck herself with all of her jewels, but we still have to continue functioning. At this stage, at least, the argument of the Arab, the Jew is, there's no point in doing anything. Forget about it all. Stop plowing. Undo the ox. Undo the plow. But of course, that's only a provisional statement, because what happens next is, when he was busy with him, the ox lowed another time. The Arab said to him, bind your ox, bind your plow, for the Redeemer of the Jews was born. Oh, what perfect timing. Obviously, it should be clear we're not speaking of a coincidence here. What's the significance of this extraordinary juxtaposition between the destruction of the temple and the birth of Mashiach? As Maharal notes, this is the first source in Maharal on the third page, כאשר געת פעם ראשונה אמר שחרה ובפעם השנייה אמר שלולד משיח. כי כבר אמרנו למעלה כי חולבן הבית הוא סיבה להרעייתו. Ironically, it is the destruction of the temple that serves as the cause, the reason, the basis for its coming into being. מפני שהדבר השלם לא יתהווה. Because when something is complete, it is, but it does not become. And so ironically, it is the very destruction that serves as the precondition for the rebuilding. Of course, on a basic down-to-earth level, we can all readily appreciate that. If you have a decrepit, crumbling building, what's the first step in setting matters right? Exactly. The wrecking ball. You have to knock it down. The first step in the rebuilding is to get back to the baseline, ground zero, as it were, and start moving anew. And thus, to that extent, Maharal said by way of conclusion, I'm skipping to the last lines of that passage, Ki chulban abayit asher chulban elav be'atzmo hu siba lehavaya yoter elyona me'od. While destruction is a particular act of destruction with respect to the temple, it is the basis of a new level of building, a new level of completeness that was hitherto unattainable. And we should note that this too is something that applies not only to the nation of Israel, but applies to the entire world. After all, the Gemara, alluding to the same inyan, that we saw expressed in the Midrash previously speaks of the atonement to the nations of the world coming through the temple. Indeed, the Gemara says, Sechatsuka, Oy lahem lo hatikah ravim sha'abdu ve'in yadim ma'sha'abdu. Woe to the nations of the world, the idolaters who lost and don't even realize what they lost. That when the temple was standing, Nisbeth mechaper alehim. Altar was atoning for them. Achshav mi mechaper alehim. And now, what atones for them? Indeed, the Midrash expresses this more pointedly, saying, Ilu hayu umot ha'olam yod'im ma hayah mikdash shekelahem kastriyot hayu makifim of Tokidei HaShavot. Were the nations of the world to have appreciated what the temple was doing for them, they would have surrounded it with legions in order to protect it. So this level of destruction, then, is something that pertains not only to the nation of Israel, and for consequence, then, the potential for rebuilding applies not only to the nation of Israel as well. This is a point that Rav Dessler expresses in Mikhtav Meliyahu, that on the one hand, Chuban Beit HaMikdash Mimenu Yitashtu She'ar Chubanot Adi Kvotetu Kishodot HaOlam HaZeh, that from the destruction of the temple derived, extended, all other destructions to the point of the collapse of the foundations of this world. And yet, precisely because of that, this is what precipitates the revelation of the light of Mashiach. So the destruction itself serves as, that's the kernel of redemption and the light of Mashiach. And so then, the summons is to renew one's efforts. At this point, yes.
Is the lack of consciousness on the part of the Goyim, is that critical to that salvation or that...
Lack of consciousness in what sense?
In the sense to understand the value of the Mikdash for them.
Yes.
Is that motif of this being salvific for the Gentiles, does that require the lack of consciousness or...
Evidently not, because again, recall that the Midrash that we saw on the previous page on Bachotiv Kev Balala posits that the nations of the world actually wept.
But they didn't.
Well, I guess it depends who. That is, my Balvatish resolution of the apparent divergence between these sources is that it is possible to sense this, and there are those who do. And parenthetically, as you know, I personally, and I'm sure everyone here, knows members of the nations of the world who fall into that category. There are others who manifestly did not appreciate that, but there are certainly those who do, and continue to this day, to sense how spiritually significant it is for them and the world for the nation of Israel to return to the land of Israel and ultimately to be able to rebuild the temple. In any case, to return to our story, at this point, what is of paramount importance for our hero is to figure out where Mashiach is. And the answer that the Arab gives him should be startling for us. Again, the capital of Arabia, apart from the obvious anomaly of identifying Beit Lechem as the capital of Arabia, we can immediately discern a disparity between what the Midrash is telling us here and other sources that we have. There is a very famous passage in the Gemara in Perek Chelek of Sanhedrin that describes a dialogue between Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi and Eliyahu, where Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi asks Eliyahu, when is Mashiach coming? And Eliyahu says, go ask him. Well, where am I supposed to find him? So in our text of the Gemara, there are variants here. In our text, Apit Chazikata, at the entrance of the city. And that was clearly the version that Rashi had based upon the manner in which Rashi comments on that. However, Hakot Agra amends the text and has instead Apitcha de Romi, at the entrance of Rome, which is also one of the versions that appears in Ein Yaakov. I should note that in a later Midrashic work, in Agadat Bereshit, we have explicitly the statement that Ro'im et HaMashiach Nitzmach Mishare Yom Romi, that Mashiach sprouts up from the gates of Rome. Of course, in the graphic and extremely poignant description that appears in Perek Chelek, the salient feature of Mashiach is he's sitting there together with all of the poor people whose bodies are full of festering sores, and the identifying attribute of Mashiach, as opposed to all the other poor people there, is everyone else takes off all of his bandages, cleans them out, and rebandages all the sores. Mashiach does them one by one, lest he be summoned to redeem the nation and the world, he shouldn't be caught with his bandages off. So he has one bandage to wrap on and immediately sally forth to redeem you. So that's the identity of Mashiach, in any case, as presented in Perichela. Again, I reiterate, there we speak of Rome. Here, of Arabia. Note, of course, that last of the two have in common is the capital. While Rome, identified as the capital of the Holy Roman Empire, may be something of an anachronism for us, and has been noted on innumerable occasions in the past, the Holy Roman Empire ended up neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. But with respect to the symbolism here of Mashiach specifically coming from the capital city, as Maharal notes, this is something to which we actually are quite accustomed, because it really is something that harks back to the first Redeemer.
Not sure.
Exactly. The first Redeemer grew up in the palace of the king, the palace of Paro. Because on some level, the role of the Redeemer is to redeem Malchut, to redeem kingship from wherever it has devolved, and to restore it to its ultimate level of function. And to that extent then, where the Malchut of whoever's Malchut it is ends, Mashiach begins. But as for the disparity between our Medrash and the Gemara, comments Maharal, well, of course, predictably, Maharal didn't regard this as a historic narrative anyway. It's to be understood on an abstracted plane. What is the salient message of the disparity between these sources? We don't know which Malchut will be ascended at the time that Mashiach comes. And, you know, nowadays, I don't think we're any closer to having any sense of which one will be ascendant. Arabe, Arabia, or Rome? Islam, or Christendom? But whichever it is, that's where Mashiach comes from. That is, wherever Malchut is to be discerned in the world, that is precisely the context from which Mashiach springs. I can't help but note that, in particular with respect to the identity of Arabia in this vein, there are a number of tantalizing passages in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer. I'll note parenthetically, but only parenthetically, that the references to Yishmael, to Arabia in Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer, leave academics to posit that, at the very least, the editing of Pirkei Rabbi Eliezer as we have it was completed after the expansion of the Muslim Empire in the early 8th century, be that as it may. In any case, the Midrash, skimming to the third from last source on the fourth page here, tantalizingly lists Chamisha Asar Dvarim Atidim Yishmael La'asot La'aretz Da'acha Mitayimim, 15 things that Yishmael will be doing in Eretz Israel, in Acharit Hayamim, the end of days. Just some of the items on the list are particularly noteworthy. Yamut Ha'aretz B'chavalim, measuring out land with measures, transforming the cemetery into a dung heap of sheep, to measure from and to the mountaintops, of course the mountaintops of Eretz Israel, of the spine of Yehuda and Shomron, a proliferation of falsity, a concealment of truth, skipping to the end of the list. And moreover, filling in the breaks, the breaches of the walls of the temple and building the building in the sanctuary. In any case, with respect to this narrative, the Midrash and Pirkei Eliezer continues by speaking of three calamitous battles that take place in Eretz Israel through the hand of Bnei Yishmael Be'achavit Hayamim. And what is perhaps particularly relevant is to observe that the final one is Be'achat Bichach Gadol Shiberom. Now how that jives with it being in Eretz Israel is a good question. But in any case, you notice the juxtaposition here as well of Yishmael with Rome. The role of Yishmael in the process of Acharit HaYamim is likewise affirmed in the following source, which is from Perek Lamed Bet in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, where the Midrash gives us a rather terrifying alternative derivation of the name Yishmael, which in addition, after all, to being the name designated for Yishmael when the Malach spoke to Hagar, seems at least prima facie to have been independently given to Yishmael by Abraham. Says the Midrash, the name Yishmael signifies She'atid HaKadosh Baruch Hu Lishmoa B'kol Na'akat Ha'am V'ma She'atidim Bnei Yishmael La'asot La'aretz Da'acharei Te'amim. Yishmael, God will hear the screams of the people, referring to the Jewish people, from what Bnei Yishmael will do in Eretz Israel in the end of days. In any case, with respect to the disparity between the sources that speak of Yishmael and the sources that speak of Rom, Edom, we should note another passage in Pirkei Eliezer that speaks of Amalek becoming enmeshed with, mixed in with Bnei Yishmael. Of course, to the extent that Amalek is the sin of Esav, and therefore, on some level at least, representative of Rome, the combination of Amalek with Bnei Yishmael may obviate the need to resolve the disparity between the sources in any more specific light. Be that as it may, we return to our story. Because note, obviously, that despite the Arabs' advice to bind the ox and bind the plow and get back to work plowing the field, that is precisely what our hero doesn't do. He sells the oxen. He sells the plow. And instead, as you already know, it becomes a traveling doctor salesman. Why? Well, of course, the answer in the logic of the story is self-evident. He doesn't want to spend his time plowing fields when he has the opportunity, at least potentially, to render a service for Mashiach himself. His goal is indeed to serve Mashiach. And so he's canvassing the countryside as a traveling diaper salesman, with one goal and only one goal in mind, to get there. Again, Abdel Nasser al-Taman, until he came there, where the there, as we already noted, is self-evident. And of course, it's the supreme irony that everyone is a beneficiary of our hero here, not only all the other towns in the countryside, but everyone else when he gets there, except for Menachem. Menachem's mother isn't even interested. He basically has to beg her to take his wares. Everything he's been doing is solely to that end. And finally, she relents and accepts his wares, even without paying. He doesn't care about the money after all. This is the whole point of everything he's been doing. And yes, and here's where, of course, our story takes on a particularly somber, even crushing tone. At the end of it all, when he comes back to check on that baby, how's he doing? Everyone has been a beneficiary of his diaper selling enterprise. Everyone that is. Except one baby. Oh, where is he? He's gone. Just after you came, then obviously, before he had any opportunity to be a beneficiary of your wares, winds and storms arose and snatched him from my hands, and he's not here anymore. That whole enterprise, dedicating himself, heart and soul, to rendering a service to Mashiach, seems to have slipped through his fingers. And yet, two crucial points that I think we should bear in mind in light of what this Midrash is telling us. The first is fairly self-evident. The first is, well, he still has diapered the countryside, and let that not strike us as inconsequential. He thought that it was no longer important for him to plow the fields of the world, because he wanted to render a service directly to Mashiach. He still is engaging, whether he knew it or not, whether he appreciated it or not, in the enterprise of Tikkun Olam, of perfecting the world. And there are an awful lot of happy babies and satisfied mothers because of what he was doing in covering the countryside, going from town to town and country to country, selling his diapers. He rendered service. It's not for Mashiach. Then it leads to the world. That is the more straightforward addendum to add to the storyline. But of course there is an additional one, which is actually explicit in the passage, even if the implications, I think, are considerably more subtle. Remember, that's not the way the story ends. The story ends is, he said to her, did I not say to you that attended to him it was destroyed, and attended to him it will be rebuilt? Which, of course, in context seems like a thoroughly incongruous addendum. But in context, I think the message should be clear. That is, no, he is rendering a service for Mashiach. But in effect, what our hero is telling Menachem's mother is, he's not gone. We don't see him. We don't know where he is. But he's there. And even if, to mortal, flesh and blood eyes, the fruits of our efforts in rendering to him a service are and remain not discernible, still and all, everything that we're doing is indeed rendering a service for this baby. Attendant to whom the temple will be rebuilt. He's someplace, and he still is the beneficiary of those efforts. That is, irrespective of the extent to which in the here and now there seems to be an abysmal, unbridgeable gap between the efforts that we expend and that final goal, ultimately there is a bridge. Ultimately those efforts are devoted to, and moreover, contributes to, that final redemption when Mashiach is sent to sally forth and redeem the world. And I think what it inevitably directs us toward is to consider just what the interface point is between what we might otherwise have considered efforts that are contributory to final redemption and efforts that are not. And that brings me to the final page of the source sheet in front of you. Cryptic verse in Shir HaShirim is cryptic when we attempt to elucidate it in light of the allegory, Iti mi Lebanon kala, iti mi Lebanon tavoi. With me from Lebanon, O bride, with me from Lebanon you will come. We already noted that Lebanon is consistently a pseudonym for the temple in Talmudic and Midrashic literature, and it certainly serves in that role here as well. So, to read the verse then in its allegorical sense, God says to the nation of Israel, with me from the temple, O bride. The promise, as Rashi expresses it, based upon the Midrash, that when the nation of Israel goes into exile, God's presence, as it were, goes with it. We're never alone. God, so to speak, accompanies us into exile. But in light of that understanding, the second clause seems problematic, because the second clause is speaking about the return. Tavoi, you will come. And as such, we would expect that the preposition would be not mi Lebanon, but li Lebanon. With me, to Lebanon, to the rebuilt temple, you will come. So why is it mi Lebanon? And the essence of what Rashi tells us, I would summarize as, if we ask ourselves, at what point does the nation of Israel take its first step to the restored, rebuilt temple of the future? The answer is, the first step out of the second temple going up in flames. A vast, tortuous, but ultimately closed path that leads back to where we were, and then some. The entire route is part of that continuum leading towards the final goal. It has, I must concede, always troubled me to speak of a particular threshold in the progression of our history as Ikvata Dimshicha or Reshit Smichat Yulatenu, because there's a vast continuum from that first step that is all part of the gathering momentum and increasing light that ultimately leads to that final goal of redemption. Yerushalayim, says the Gemara, in Brachot Daf Nun Chet, is forever. The Netzach Zo Yerushalayim. Yerushalayim represents not the temporal nor the transient, but rather the eternal and permanent. And that is, everyone here is familiar with the moving passage at the end of Masechet Makot. Rabbi Akiva and the other sages, seeing the destroyed grounds of the temple, the fox emerging from the ruins of the inner sanctum of the temple. And for Rabbi Akiva, this is cause for celebration, because he sees the juxtaposition of the nevuah ascribed to Uriah, which we read in Micha, Nehemiah, Lachin, Biglachem, Sion, Sadete, Charesh. Therefore, because of you, Sion will be plowed under like a field, and the nevuah of Zechariah, Od Yeshvu, Zekenim, Zekenot, Birchorot, Yerushalayim, Be'ish, Mishanto, Biadom, Erov, Yamim, Urchorot, Ha'iri, Yimalu, Yiladim, Yiladot, Misafakim, Birchorotah. There will yet dwell old men and old women in the squares of Yerushalayim, and man with his walking staff in hand from old age, and the squares of the city will be filled with boys and girls playing in the streets. The destruction itself serves as the herald for that restoration. Now there's a terrifying verse in Amos, Nafla lo tosif kum betulat Yisrael. The daughter of Israel has fallen, not to rise again. Such a terrifying verse that the Gemara tells us at the beginning of the Sefer Brachot and Daf Dalet that David, anticipating this verse, deleted Nun from the acrostic of Asherah. So there shouldn't be any allusion to that nifilah, to that fall. But the Gemara simultaneously tells us that in Eretz Israel they have a different way of punctuating the verse. They read it as Nafla velotosiklin polod, kum gulat Yisrael, having fallen never to fall again, arise, daughter of Israel. So is this merely a sleight of hand? I would submit that it is not. Rather, we have another verse in Amos that speaks in similar terms of falling, the falling sukkah of David. But there's a promise there of Akim et Sukkat David Hanofelet, that God will raise up the falling Sukkah of David. And in Midrash, in Batei Midrashot, we find a juxtaposition of these two verses, that while the daughter of Israel does not rise again by herself, ultimately she will be lifted up by God. And there's a very poignant comment in this vein that appears in Keter Rosh, which is a record in the name of Rav Chaim Volozhiner, of what he heard from the Vilna Gaon, commenting on this terrifying verse that speaks of an irreversible fall. That Betulat Yisrael, as he goes on to say, Mechunam b'shem mapelet sukkat David hanofelet, klomar asher b'chol yom hi nofelet. Described as falling in the present tense, because the falling continues to be relentless. Every day, falling gets further, falling more abysmally, more catastrophically. And again, every day, the present tense nofelet is the appropriate description. Hence, again, Sukkat David is not Sukkat David Shenachla, but Sukkat David Hanofelet, on an ongoing basis, falling and continuing to fall. Ki adayin Hanofelet ad shetagia lemadrigah tachtona velo tuchal od limfol. As long as she keeps on falling, she continues to be known as the faller, present tense. Until, and it's a terrifying statement, but
something that is simultaneously terrifying and yet consoling, until there's no place left to fall. Hitting rock bottom. Familiar with the 12-stage program, which hitting rock bottom is, if anything, the summons for a person to pick himself up by his bootstraps and reorient and begin anew. And when the Tulad Israel hits rock bottom, then there is indeed the promise that Atak Far Higya LeHazman Kum B'Tulad Israel. That's the summons. Arise, daughter of Israel. It's not merely a sleight of hand. Rather, appreciating the present tense of Nofelet so relentlessly is an appreciation of the promise of the restoration of Kum B'Tulad Israel, as expressed specifically by the Chachamim B'Ma'arava in Eretz Israel. To appreciate that in the destruction, there is indeed the herald of a new beginning. That is, as we express it in Shir Ma'alot, Hazolim Bidina Bidinaitso, it's specifically through sowing in tears that we can look forward to reaping in exaltation. Halochi Lechu Vachov Nosel Meshach Hazara. By weeping, as we bear the load of seed, we have the promise of Bo Yavo Vina Nosel Motav, bearing ultimately the sheaves of the harvest in rejoicing. And so when we consider what our story here is telling us, obviously is by no means any sort of glib promise of everything going just the way we want it. And again, we reiterate, Mashiach remains elusive. In our world, we don't see the correlation between our efforts and the ultimate goal. But we still have the affirmation that that correlation, even if unobservable by us, exists. And everything that we do ultimately advances that final goal. May we indeed, by dint of our efforts, have the wherewithal to advance and to witness that final conclusion. Thank you for your forbearance.
Thank you.
Well, it's not only those that
kind of... Mm-hmm.